This episode, I'm joined once again by philosopher Vincent Bloch to discuss the concept of the homo virtualis, creative destruction, and artificial intelligence. I'd like to give thanks to all my paying patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible, and if you would like to support the podcast, please find links in the description below. Otherwise, please enjoy. So, Vincent Bloch, thanks very much once again for joining us on Hermetics Podcast. We are going to be discussing something that happened to fall into my inbox, a short, I believe it's an inaugural lecture for your appointment, your new post, which I think has a long title, but the title of the piece, so this is about 50 pages long roughly, is Philosophy of Technology in the Digital Age, the Datafication of the World, the Homo Virtualis, and the Capacity of Technological Innovations to Set the World Free, which is a very bold title. So, yeah, before we jump in, discussions on technology, virtuality, the future of the human, tell us a little bit about the history of this this lecture.
Yeah, James, thank you very much for having me again. Hermeutics is, of course, one of my favorite podcasts, so I'm happy to be in here and to contribute to it. So as you indicated, this booklet is the product of my, or the outcome of my inaugural address. So I was recently appointed as professor at Wageningen in the Netherlands, and that gave me the opportunity to bring together the material that I've been working on and to also in a systematic way try to make sense of my position in philosophy of technology and also in discussion with others, and also to explore a little bit what are, according to me, the relevant avenues for future research that I will engage in with my team, but maybe it also inspires others. So that is where it comes from and what is the ambition of the book. And in the end, I'm working in a continuous flow on articles and books on these areas. So I assume that many things will follow, or I hope at least.
I'm already going off track from the questions I sent you, but because, you know, Heidegger is your specialty. Heidegger is where you wrote your dissertation, as you were talking about before we started recording. You know, in relation to Heidegger, the question concerning technology, has technology always been sort of a personal question for you? The philosophy of technology, is this something you saw and thought, this is something I want to tackle?
Yeah, in a way, that is indeed the case. So when I started to study philosophy back in the 90s, there was already a concern, or also in my philosophy school in Leiden, to think about what Foucault once called the ontology of the present. Huh? So what is the human condition? What is the world situation today? And we cannot omit or neglect then the role of technology as constituting part in this reality that we live. And back then, the main reason to focus on technology is also that there is a risk in environmental philosophy, in philosophical anthropology, to be hesitant or to be more negative about technology and to talk about philosophical anthropology or cultural philosophy that is then disconnected from technology. While I believe, and that is the way I'm trained, and that's how I read also Heidegger, technology is also part of this reality we cannot get rid of. And even if we are critical, we have to confront ourselves with it instead of longing for past times of windmills and all these type of things like some people blamed Heidegger for, that he was a romantic. I don't believe that. He was one of the first philosophers who really exchanged or confronted himself with this new reality. And that's also what I try to do myself.
Well, a windmill is still technology, right? That's the problem. Yeah. It's the problem that people think about. But that's the first question here is, one thing that this lecture does emphasize, and it's something that some critics of technology are quick to disagree with, though I'm in agreement with you, is this bundling of all technology together. And then you have, once again, this sort of romantic view of primitivism or things like that, where a computer and a hammer come under the same rubric, which is, as far as I'm concerned, ridiculous. So one of the focuses is on this question of how new technologies are more disruptive than old technologies. Why do you think this is an important question? How do you view this?
So it is. Let's start with the idea that, and that is, I think that everybody agrees that if you look at digital technologies today and the way that AI, for instance, is influencing societal debates, that it's relatively easy to say that digital technologies are disruptive. Eh? So they are disrupting societal arrangements, so to speak. And then the question is now what is happening today with technology? So the digital revolution, is that now a completely different disruption if we compare it, for instance, with the industrial revolution? And although I agree with the fact that a computer is not the same as a hammer, as you indicated, maybe we have to shift a little bit the perspective and we have to take the stance of innovation instead of technology, because technology often has the tendency to start with an artifact and then to reflect on it, while innovation that is already identified by Schumpeter is seen as creative destruction. So the innovation like the steam engine or the invention of the telescope or the mechanical clock, these are innovations, or these are technologies that are not only constituting new artifacts in the world that we can deal with, but they also reshuffle, redesign social, political, economic, and I would say even ontological structures. For instance, the telescope, and that's a classical example. Shift from the heliocentric to the geocentric to the heliocentric worldview brought about. So that's not only an artifact; it's really a disruption of the way we experience the world and also our role in this world. Because if we are no longer the center of the universe, but we have an astral point of view in which we can look at the Earth as just one planet, as all the other planets, also the way we understand human existence changes. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing. Technology or innovations create a new world. And the idea of creative destruction, and that's also what you can illustrate with the telescope as this classical example, is that it's not only the creation of something new, it's also the destruction of what is existing. So like the invention of the telescope created a new world in which we live and act together and we understand human existence in a different way. It also destructed the existing geocentric world. And I believe that in this regard, it is hard to distinguish between old technology and new technology. There are technologies, of course, not necessarily old technology, but there are technologies or innovations that have this potential of creative destruction. And I don't see a principal difference between the invention of the telescope as a disrupting technology and the invention of AI or digital technologies as such a disruption. And I tend to look at it from this perspective. Maybe that is a first indication of an answer to your question.
Yeah. I mean, the word there that's interesting is innovation. So innovation definitely has a telos, a teleology. Yeah. It has a direction. Now this is sort of where I personally fall away from technology, because it seems there is a lot of people who are, we could say, innovators, developers of technology, believe in an unspoken agreement as to what that direction should be, even though there has been no collective agreement as to what constitutes innovation, what constitutes progress. So when we speak of innovation, it seems to go hand in hand with the process of destruction. So it seems as we simultaneously innovate, we equally are destroying something, ourselves, the human. Yeah. But it does seem there might be a limit. So you give the you give the example of a telescope that takes us from as you say geocentric. But there's got to. Do you think there's going to be a point where perhaps we basically just relegated ourselves so much that there is no more deconstruction? We sort of find our place, or do you think there's always the deconstructive potential for technology, and also the question of what exactly is innovation?
Yeah. So one of the things, if we talk about the nice thing of taking the perspective of innovation rather than technology is that technology in one way or another provides the impression of a status quo. So there is an end product, for instance, the steam engine or the first internet or something like that, which is then a sort of a new reality as an artifact in the world, while innovation as a word already indicates both an activity, a process, the process of emerging something radically new, which is not around yet in the world, and it's the outcome of it. Mm. So it enables you to look at it from a more process perspective. And indeed, you are completely right. This process perspective shows that there's a simultaneous movement from creation and destruction at the same time. And that is already in critical perspective towards all the true believers in innovation as the panacea for all our societal problems, because most of the OECD and all these European policymakers, they see the bright side of life, the bright side of technology and innovations as all the problem that solves all our problems, while there is a dark side of the moon. There is this destructive reality that is going hand in hand with this process of emerging new things. Then the question is, what is this direction? And what is the role, for instance, of humans? So that is also an assumption that humans are the primary agent in this process of innovation. While that is highly questionable, because if you look at the history of technology, technological developments, or the history of inventions, then there is all kinds of interdependencies, coincidences, unforeseen results. So even if we accept that there is a sort of movement or there is a sort of direction, this is not necessarily or cannot be seen as an intentional or an teleological direction. Although we can say that, for instance, the invention of the steam engine contributed to the emergence of the Industrial Revolution. And that also means the industrial society as we know it from that time onwards. So that is maybe the first thing to consider, that this process perspective of emergence that is not necessarily controllable, steerable, but it's still emerging. It's creation, but it's and also I don't want to say that the human is irrelevant, but it is also not necessarily the primary actor. I have worked on that topic in other articles. Was your question, is that then a continuous process of creative destruction, or is there a sort of end state, or is there a possibility? And that is an interesting question also to consider in relation to, again, the notion of creative destruction, because many people are critical about innovation, while I would say maybe we have to be more critical about the economic dimension of innovation. Mm. And innovation and economics is not completely the same. But the interesting thing is that the idea of creative destruction came from Schumpeter, Joseph Schumpeter, who was an economist. And he said the only way to put a limit to capitalism is innovation. Why is that the case? The economic process will always need new technologies, new artifacts, new products. To, for instance, the invention of the steam engine created a complete new economic playing field with a lot of prosperity and a lot of death and despair, as we said, because it destructed also the the world, which was dominated by water power, for instance, instead of steam. But he said, for this, we need, in order to have economic development, we need innovation. And at the same time, in the process of this innovation, there are a few actors, big players, who start to consolidate their power. Mm-hmm. So, and that's what we experience today as well, who buy the patents, who make sure that they have the tendency to consolidate power and economic power, for instance, in big concentration of big companies, like nowadays we have today with Google and Amazon and Apple and these type of players. And then his argument was, the only way we can solve this negative aspect of capitalism, namely power concentration, is because there will be new entry points for new innovations that will disrupt then the power of these big players. Mm. So for him, innovation is part of the economic process, but it's also a necessary condition for to limit the negative aspects of capitalism, so to speak. And then it becomes interesting because you can ask now yourself the question, for instance, and we are both old enough to know that there was a company which was called Kodak, for instance. Mm-hmm. They made films for photographs, for instance, and they just missed. And they were a huge company. Eh? Mm-hmm. Kodak is a superstar company in that area, and they just missed the invention of digital cameras, and they went bankrupt. So this is a clear indication or a clear example how the power, the capitalist power of big players that have a sort of hegemony in an economic system can be broken down by new innovations that can be missed and that provide new level playing fields for new entrants. And at the same time, we can question in the current situation in which we have only a few big tech companies, whether such a situation is still possible, whether it is still possible that there is a new innovation that is disrupting the power of the Amazons and the Googles and the Microsofts of this world. And so this situation that you asked for, and this whether there's a continuous process of destruction and creation in history, whether that come to an end. Now, on the one hand, that is the good question to ask in the current time frame, whether that is still possible with these big tech companies that we face. And that calls then for a fundamental political economic reflections, I would say. And it shows also that maybe not technology itself is the problem in this regard, but that the economic context in which innovations appear and are appreciated, that is maybe more, so to speak, the problem at this moment.
It's interesting because you were talking earlier about how, you know, it's not just human actors that are the trajectory for this sort of almost unspoken force. And there's been plenty of writing in recent years from philosophers about the notion of, the notion of capitalism itself or the market forces themselves as the intelligence itself, as the artificial intelligence itself, being able to quantify, you know, which direction to go in pretty much by the profit mechanism. And so this brings me to one of the key cornerstones of your text, which is data. Is the difference, it seems now, is that these big companies are in their utilization of data, are utilizing an intelligence which is, you know, is not within our capabilities. You know, summing up masses and masses of data in such a way that is inhuman. You know, they're making decisions that are, you know, not based on emotion. They're not based on it. They're based on numerics. They're based on pure quantification. And so, data is sort of overlooked now. You know, we've it's so commonplace that we don't even think about it. But data is fast becoming pretty much everything, and in that the human is lost. So, you know, how do you think about data?
For a philosopher, especially if you are coming from this continental philosophical perspective, in which you tend to accept that there is not only a flat ontology of entities in the world and their interrelations with other entities, like Latour, for instance, argues, or originally he argued at least. But you accept that there is a sort of a world, a meaningfulness that is beyond these entities. There is a sort of unifying principle, whether it's language, whether it's there are also people who talk about technology as this meaning constituting, but you can also think about poetry and art and all that kind of things. And for me, if you, I would say that data is indeed a sort of word that is not indicating a physical entity or a physical reality, but is more to be seen as a metaphysical structure. Mm-hmm. And so we have you and me sitting in front of each other, mediated by this computer and this internet connection. But in a way, this is a translation of a data set. And so you appear at the same time as a data set, or you are the emerging phenomenon that is emerging from a data set. That is the way we normally look at it. And I am interested, before we can become critical about the reductionism that is at stake in data, in the datification, we have to think about what is the scope of this notion of data. Is it indeed the case that everything is data, and that you as a person are just the epiphenomenon of a data set? Mm. Now, if you ask an engineer, but also maybe if you ask your, for instance, I have diabetes, and my general practitioner, he will just measure data sets in my in blood, my blood, for instance, to indicate whether I'm on the good or right track for my treatment, for instance. So an engineer is already inclined to think and to accept also that you are in principle a data set, and also in philosophy, you have this in these analytical philosophy schools, Nick Bostrom and others, who then say, hey, how do we know whether we live in an simulation? Can we know for sure that we are not living in a simulation, for instance? And these type of people also tend to say that the scope of this data is so broad that it is indeed, they will not talk in terms of an ontological structure, but then you can say, in a way, an AI system, that's an example of a ChatGPT or AI systems, they presuppose that intelligence, it can be understood in terms of algorithmic calculations based on big data sets. Mm-hmm. And that is what is reality. And then the question is there any difference between human intelligence and intelligence which is algorithmic in this regard?
Is there?
Yeah, there is. But we have first to accept this fully, because I believe that otherwise we run the risk of becoming romantics ourselves. And by separating between a sort of that we say, yeah, James and me, we are real humans, and though the bad guys outside, they reduce us to a data set, something like that. While it is our reality, James, that you are mediated by this computer. You have friends via your social media. If, for instance, in my case, if I'm ill, I accept that my general practitioner is assessing me as a data set. Mm-hmm. So it is not so easy to distinguish between the two domains as if they are completely opposed to each other. They are becoming more and more intertwined. And that is, I believe, more our reality. Mm. And why I say this also, because I, for instance, also a philosopher like Heidegger, although he was very nuanced, I believe, you can easily say that he was, in the end, relatively negative about technology and framing as the world of technology that we are living in. Mm-hmm. Although he was talking about releasement, gelassenheit toward this domain of technology, but it has the tendency to these type of philosophers, for instance, more recent Jean-Luc Nancy as well. They try to talk about the whole world that we are living in now, this datafied or computational world, as an unworld, there is an original world and then there is an unworld or of the technology. I would say no, maybe we have to start that this is our world, and then within this world maybe we have to look for points of resistance, points where we can say, okay, there is a difference between human intelligence and artificial intelligence, or the data set that is not completely congruent with the physical reality, for instance.
It seems to be a difference between quantity and quality, and it's sort of an age-old philosophical question. But it also brings me to something that I think about a lot at the moment, because I do see that AI could be a somewhat overhauling technology, and already is. But much like with the birth of the internet, one of the things that intrigues me about the sort of, you know, we're watching the birth of AI really in real time, is that it's first, as is the case, I think, with the history of technologies, singular technologies in general, the first use cases are usually not what it will be down the line. So the first things we've been using AI for on a public scale is the creation of art, which seems like the most useless non-artificial intelligence use of this intelligence. So it seems to me that the creation of art is born from, you know, this is a question that we could throw around for ages as to why human beings create art. That's not a question that's ever going to be answered. But with AI, it is. It's because we ask the AI to make the art. So it's making it off, you know, a quantified assumption of all this data that it has. And so it seems in that question of art, in that question of creation, once again, there is a context and a limit to artificial intelligence, which we've already tried to broach, but it's just not really, it's not really working.
Yeah, but maybe one of the things, one of the indications that we can and that we can explore to make sense of this limit is that let's take this example of this open letter by OpenAI on this temporary ban on AI developments. What you can see in these type of letters and also letters and warnings that you can find on the internet is that the idea is, today maybe it is still in its infancy, artificial intelligence, but one day it will outperform human intelligence. Mm-hmm. And the principal problem here is that if you say that something is in its infancy and one day will outperform human intelligence, that you already assume an congruency between the intelligence that is at stake in artificial intelligence and in human intelligence. So even if you don't think about this, already this sentence already testifies of a sort of assumption in this regard, while you can say, is it now the case that there is this congruency between intelligence in case of artificial reality and in case of human intelligence, or is that a sort of congruency that is made by these tech, by these companies and by these people that are calling for this? That is also why you can be critical about these type of open letters, because you can say, why are they starting with these open letters to call for a ban? If they produce these AI themselves, is it not the case that they try to ripen the minds for this concurrency that is not at stake, because your intelligence is in many ways incomparable with any artificial system? But by talking about it this way, by talking about ChatGPT as an language generative AI, for instance, you build this idea of congruency. And as soon as you experience that there is a sort of power to make congruency, then you can be sure there is no congruency, because otherwise you don't have to make it anymore.
I mean, I guess it's a broad question then. I mean, what is your, I guess, in an empirical sense, or maybe even a social sense, what are your own projections concerning AI? I mean, where do you stand on it? I mean, there's the spectrum of what we're talking about. Of course, there's this question of the congruency. As soon as you place AI forward, you're as something which will outgrow human intelligence, you're placing them on the same spectrum. But there's a spectrum of appreciation for AI. On one side, you have people who'd say it's a tool, much like a hammer in a way, and human beings can wield it and just use it, but it's always under our control. And on the other side of the spectrum is, you know, almost the cyberpunk sci-fi fantasies of it's quite literally, it's an intelligence in the sense of almost gaining a consciousness that could have its own agenda. And that is the worry, that it would somehow have its own agency and, you know. But I think there's a ton of philosophical questions there which have problems, which is how could we assume what that agency would even want to do? It might, you know, I personally think from an old sci-fi story that I read that any AI would be probably sufficiently antinatalist and it would just turn itself off straight away because it wouldn't, you know, why would it bother? Anyway. So where are you on this spectrum of...
Yeah, so I try to limit myself here to things that I believe that I can say something about as a philosopher. Mm-hmm. And so you can, because I'm not a futurist or a sort of, and otherwise I should be a sort of futurologist or something like that. And that is not why that's not my training, so to speak. But you can say that, in a way, you can say that in the conceptualization of artificial intelligence, there is a very particular and I would say narrow understanding of the operation of intelligence. And on the one hand, you can say that you can to a certain extent say that what this algorithm based on data is doing, that you can find something like that also in cases of human decision making, for instance. It is not a problem to accept that some of your operations as a human intelligent animal mimic a little bit or are a little bit comparable with these operations, algorithmic operations. But it is not to say that we can extend this particular domain of or operationalization of intelligence to the full understanding of intelligence. To give an example, the artificial intelligence is an algorithm that is, there's feed, is an input in historical data. So it's always in a temporary sense, extrapolating from previous or past data, extrapolating to future data. Now you, as if you read something of Heidegger at least, or if the listener something read from Heidegger, is the basic idea that human existence is being towards death. That means, of course, you are mortal, but it's also the case that Heidegger argues that human being, so that also means human intelligence, is always with foresight returning to the present. So it's not only extrapolating from the past towards the future, but the unique aspect of human existence that it's also backwards from the future to the present, because your future death determines why, partly at least, why you are here and why I am here and why we are talking with each other and why we think it makes sense. And it's important to have this conversation to make sense of the world. Now, this difference in temporal orientation of human intelligence versus artificial intelligence is something that cannot be taken or is not taken into account in the idea that current artificial intelligence is in its infancy but will outperform human intelligence in the future, maybe. It's just neglecting the principal difference of the temporality of human intelligence and artificial intelligence. And I would say we can be much more friendly, open, constructive towards artificial intelligence if we accept that there is a fundamental, or there are also dichotomies between the two that are not completely congruent and also cannot be made congruent. So it's also a sort of mantra. This is sort of maybe a sort of marketing to do as if the two types of intelligence are comparable in a way, while that is not necessarily the case.
I mean, there's also two other Heideggerian differences there, I guess, in a way that the AI isn't thrown into the world. It's quite literally been developed.
Yeah.
And also, yeah, you know, being in the world that humans have with our innate familiarity with the world, AI doesn't have a familiarity with the world. I mean, it is a
because that's also in a very literal sense that you can say that AI is building on past data. So like you were thrown in the world and you learned your language, your mother tongue, from your parents. So you can say also ChatGPT learns its mother tongue from predecessors or previous data. But for instance, the problem with this is that only high correlations, so many instances, predict correlations between words in ChatGPT, while, for instance, you can have a singular traumatic experience, for instance, your birth, which is a singular experience that is traumatic in the sense that it is determining your existence. And that is also the difference between human intelligence and artificial intelligence, that the singular event in your life can be very important in the determining what is making sense in your life, while in case of artificial intelligence, what counts most is high levels of correlation. So singularity is not relevant. Is in a way, singularity is in this regard, the singularity of experience is not important.
Okay. Well, speaking of this role of the human, I mean, because another part of your, I do want to get to this other part of your paper, this book, and the something you mentioned already, something that does come from Heidegger as well, you know, him being very careful about the romanticism towards this, like, capital H human. Is there a split between human and technology? Is the, you know, the real human? You can fall very quickly into primitivist notions of the human. We have a history in a history in philosophy of this transformation of the Homo sapien. So you start with the Homo sapien, and then Foucault is probably the most notable. He mentions the Homo criminalis. You know, once you have criminality, we can forever be a human, that it's possible to be a criminal. And then he moves through to the Homo economicus. You know, we're completely embroiled and intertwined with economy. We are economic. Then also Homo politicus, if you want, political man. And now we have your own next step in the development of the evolution of the human, which is the Homo virtualis. But this doesn't, is this an option? We don't seem to, you know, are we just completely intertwined with the virtual now? The virtual and the real, I mean, that almost is a dialogue between romantic and future.
Yeah. If you want. Yeah. Yeah. So, again, and here maybe that is maybe also the inspiration from Ernst Jünger, also one of my intellectual fathers, is this tendency to confront ourselves completely with the new reality that we face in the digital age, for instance, that I introduce this notion of an Homo virtualis, which doesn't mean that I envision that as a sort of ideal, positive situation, but I just try to reflect on the question, what does this world, digital world, or this world of pen computationalism or dataism, or what word we choose, what does it mean for human existence? And what is the, and maybe I say something that is then offensive to some of the post-humanist listeners to this podcast, but I try to be as friendly as possible in this. You can say that in previous times, so in the times before the digital revolution, things had a sort of substantial existence. Things have a material, substantive existence. And then one of the issues that is discussed in the literature a lot already is that in terms of data, then the if the world appears as a data set, then the question is, what is the role of materiality? Is there still a substantial material existence? And for instance, if Nick Bostrom is talking about the fact, do we believe or can we say that we are not living in a simulation? And if there is not an argument to say this, then that means that you accept that there is no material existence. There is a complete virtuality. And that is also why, for instance, trends like mentalism is very popular nowadays. There is no material existence. There's only mental existence. That is the only thing. So it is not something that I invented. This is something that is around in several debates. And one of the things that you can say about this former existence as substantial existence was that these substances were categorized by dichotomies. And dichotomies like gender, nature, culture, and all kinds of dichotomies. And that in the time of or the era of digitalization and the datafication of everything, that especially these type of dichotomies become fluid. Mm-hmm. Namely, the difference, the dichotomy between the virtual world and the physical world become fluid. We can no longer completely distinguish between a physical existence and a virtual existence anymore. So in a way, you can say that in this digital era, a new structure or metastructure of the world emerges, namely the world as a data set, in which classical dichotomies become fluid and also partly become absent. And you can imagine that people like post-humanists are, at least theoretically speaking, although they might be very much against digitalization, technology, and all that kind of things, that they should be in favor of these type of tendencies, because from a post-humanist perspective, you would say it is great that we are destructing all these dichotomies that were from the previous centuries and that were Western capitalist metaphysical philosophical traditions. So in this regard, you can say that materiality is no longer relevant in this world of data, and that also human existence as is then becoming a human virtualis to contrast it with this materiality and this existence that is bounded by all kinds of dichotomies. And so that is more of an reflection on what is the consequence of allowing this new reality of datification in our reality. What are the positive possible positive aspects, namely the congruency between virtualization and post-humanism? And then, of course, what are the consequences for our understanding of human existence? And then you can become more critical about what is at stake here and whether it is not necessary to keep certain boundaries, an asymmetry between you and your environment, for instance. And so it is not the case that I am presenting the homo virtualis as I'm my new a new hero, so to speak, but it's more an analysis of how I believe that the way we understand human existence changes in this digital revolution, and what are the potentialities, but also what are the potential risks or limitations of such an understanding.
Well, I think you were right at the beginning of the discussion. You were right in saying that this is we can't really separate this now from economic discussions, because I think of someone, I mean, I think of two philosophers sort of together. I think of Deleuze with his virtuality, you know, very roughly, you look at a tree and I think he writes it as it sort of, you know, unfolds as the potentiality of being wooden planks that you could go and sell. And then I think of someone such as Michel Serres, who says that when you go into the center of the rainforest, you can no longer see the rainforest because you've brought that sort of ideal with you, that you're looking at these trees thinking, we could cut all these down and we could sell them. And so you're no longer, you know, just to take the instance of a tree with this sort of virtuality, which is infecting us, invading us, if I would put it that way. The true negative there is we can no longer just see a tree. It's sort of a projective question, but it doesn't seem possible for us to, like, you know, shut that down. Everything has this potentiality, especially economically, to be a place of profit, a place of, oh, I could make some money from that, or I could, you know, I could change that into this. Nothing is, a tree is no longer just a tree. It's it's already in the future.
But here I believe that the philosophical vocabulary can add something to this debate, because we tend to distinguish between an ontic or a reality at the level of beings and entities like the tree. And I believe that at this level of beings in the world, if you open your window and you look at the tree, you still see a tree. But you have next to it, you have an ontological understanding of what is the identity of a tree, what is the real identity of this tree, what is the very nature of this tree, and then this can shift. And that is why, for instance, somebody like Nietzsche already could say God is dead. If he said God is dead, that doesn't mean that there's nobody who believes in God. There are multiple people who still, at the level of beings, can still believe in God, go to church and all that kind of things. But at an ontological level or metaphysical level, there is no reality anymore that corresponds with this. And that is the same with the tree. Of course, we do see the tree, but what changes is the ontological understanding of the identity of this tree that shifted and that disables us to understand it in the previous way or the previous setting. And the same holds with human existence. So for instance, if you now say, yes, but I'm the subject, the Cartesian subject that is in control of technology, even on the street, nobody believes you anymore. It's not necessary even to be an intellectual to reject that idea.
You don't seem to put really any possible positive or negative connotations on this. You try to enter this just as a philosopher.
First, indeed, as a philosopher. But okay, assuming that you are now a little bit sensitive for the added value, to say it in economic words, of such an approach, then of course you can raise questions. You can say, if there is no material existence, if we adhere to this idea of virtualization, and we see also the benefits of virtualization because it cuts down all the boundaries, that has also an influence of our understanding of human existence as locally embedded, as proximity. A notion like proximity or locality only makes sense if there is a sort of physicality or materiality that we are talking about. If the human becomes this virtual data processor, then there is also a difficulty to understand human singularity, because we tend to think about ourselves also as, although we know that we are not so unique, we also have the experience, or can have the experience, that my experience is my experience, and that we can talk a lot with each other, but we never can replace or exchange our own experiences. And that in this world of data, there is no room for this singularity anymore, because one data point is completely irrelevant. It's about patterns. In the whole world of data, everything is about correlations, patterns, and not about singular data. So in this regard, you can say that the question to be or not to be, as an existential question, is become secondary in this world of data, and it's also secondary for this virtual homo virtualis. And then you can start to become reluctant to accept this as an ideal, because you can, at least in your first person experience, you can experience that that you cannot comply with such an ambition or with such an ideal, so to speak. So that is where I start to bring in then more critical questions about the feasibility of this ideal of the virtuality, but also the feasibility of the cutting cross destructing all boundaries, because I think that in this regard also your singularity requires also an asymmetry between you as this singular existence compared with an outside world, for instance.
Okay. I mean, is there anything you'd like to add about your paper that you feel is key that we haven't touched upon?
Now, one thing that we didn't discuss, but that is, I believe, also important in the context of technology, because one of the criticisms, maybe I can touch upon that briefly. One of the criticisms is one of the problems is that also in this digital technology, that on the one hand it constitutes a sort of virtual world. And I believe that this virtual world is intertwined with the physical world that we are living in, because you are sitting in your room and at the same time you are with me in my room. So that in this regard, the physical and the virtual become intertwined. And at the same time, the condition for this is that there is a sort of biosphere that provides the resources to build the computer, to energize this internet system, to provide the dumping ground for at the end of life of your computer, you can say that philosophers of technology have the tendency to focus on this artifact or on this new reality, and tend to neglect this, and that is also a materiality, the materiality of a planet Earth. That has a very fragile ecosystem or biosphere that is, on the one hand, the necessary condition for the existence and the emergence of this virtual world, because it provides the data center. The data centers that constitute this world are located at the physical ground. They need energy that is coming from fossil fuel, for instance, or from solar. So this is a lot of sort of the dark side of this whole idea of the virtual world or the world of data, that there is also this very dumb materiality of planet Earth that is a necessary condition, and that is also part of our materiality, because you as a human are also material in the sense you are an earthling. And I believe that if you really want to become critical also, critical regarding this homo virtualis, then one of the entry points is the acknowledgement of this earthly existence that is purely physical in the sense of living in this biosphere, and that is conditional for all the ideas of mentalism, virtuality, and all that kind of things. So that is why I also try to, in my philosophy, try to make sense of this notion of world on the one hand as the meaningful environment that is partly virtual, partly physical or intertwined. And at the same time, the earth, which is outside of that, is asymmetric towards each other.
So we're burning up the territory to fuel the map, basically.
Yeah.
That's a sort of fairly pessimistic, it's quite a pessimistic place to finish up. But
we can also, if you want, we can also, because we started this conversation with creative destruction. Mm-hmm. If there is something like creative destruction, there is a risk, as I indicated, namely that economic powers are limiting the possibility of new innovations and new emergence of new worlds, so to speak, or disruptions. But at the same time, we can also be quite confident, if you look at history, that there will always be the new. Mm-hmm. So there's always the disruption of the current status quo. And in this regard, you can also say, we as intellectuals and philosophers, we should look for the pockets of resistance. We should look at where are these new indications of new worlds or new innovations or new developments emerging that we can contribute to. We are not subject of that development, but we can reflect on it. We can contribute to it. So I'm in this regard not pessimistic at all.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. This is, well, no, it's a good place. It's a good place to finish up. I mean, where can people find this lecture? Is this freely available or?
Yeah. So it's open. It's open access available. You can go to my website and then you can download it, or Academia or ResearchGate, all these social media entry points will lead you to the booklet. And other papers that my team and I have written on this subject.
Mm-hmm. What are you working on now? Are you working on any more books on technology?
Yeah, so that's I'm now finishing. And one of the questions also in philosophy is what we had now a very nice conversation about this virtual world or this data world. And you can ask yourself, what is now your method? What is now your method of research as a philosopher to say something about the whole of being? And so you talk about the world of data. You are talking about world and earth. What is the method that philosophers have to think about this? And how is now the artifact, for instance, the invention of an individual artifact like this first steam engine or a telescope, how is that related to the disruption of the world? Because the one is then on an ontic level, as we would call it, an entity. And on the other hand, we have a structure, a metaphysical structure of the world. How are the physical and the metaphysical connected with each other? That is what I'm currently trying to finish a paper on.
Okay. Sounds interesting. Yeah. Well, I'll be sure to put all the links for this booklet that we've been speaking about today in the description below. But Vincent Bloch, once again, it's been a great conversation. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mark.